Last week we looked at the fact that God has a plan for you. And it may or may not be what you've always dreamed of or had in mind. But God does have a plan for you. Let's go to a verse here. And I explained last week a little bit about verses Jeremiah 29:11. You know how we use Old Testament verses. And we won't go back into that. But that this does reveal God's character, and I believe it does reveal His intent toward us, even though this was specifically made to the Jewish people. We looked at some New Testament verses that basically told us the same thing. 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. And what a comforting thing to know that God has a plan for each one of us, that He has things ordained for us to do, planned out for us to do and accomplish, and a purpose in our life. And sometimes that is revealed to us over time, one step at a time. Sometimes we get a big, a lot of information at once of a direction to take. But the thing, the promise is, though, is that God has a plan for you. And no matter how successful we may appear, no matter how successful we are in the world, if it's outside of God's plan for you, then it equals failure. And who are we trying to please? God or man? God or ourselves? The way that we do what God wants us to do, this is a review from last week, by the way. The way that we do and accomplish what God wants us to do is through faith. Faith is not this thing that we wield and use for to get what we want. It's a way to get what God wants. It's a crazy thing, but God has a plan for us, and the way we walk in that plan, the way we do what God has purposed for us to do, is by putting our trust in Him, by faith. It's a means that we can do things beyond ourselves and beyond our own ability. And we had this quote last week, that was from William Carey, a missionary to India, that said, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. That if we're not trying to do things outside of our ability, our talents, then we're just probably operating in our own strength. That God desires us to do things outside of our own ability and strength. Now, He does give gifts that He gives us are a part of this. We may not be a natural teacher. But if God gifts us to teach, then it's something that it takes complete reliance on Him. That's the way most of the gifts operate. It may not be a natural talent, but yet God gives us ability to do a certain thing. With like the gift to serve, that we can serve people with endurance. We can serve people without expecting anything in return. That's outside of and beyond our own strength. And that's the way that God works. And then who gets the glory? God gets the glory. When we operate like that, God gets the glory. And then we don't restrict what He's going to do in our life through our pride and us taking what belongs to Him, His glory. The body has a job. The body, maybe you could say leadership in particular, has a job to prepare and equip each one to labor in the kingdom. That is, to do what God has called you to do. And you are in the process of getting equipped and prepared to do what God has called you to do. It does mean to get in the yoke with Christ. Let's go to this verse as a review. We'll read this verse again today as with the stuff we're going to study today. Matthew 11:28. Come to Me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take My yoke upon you and learn from Me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For My yoke is easy and My burden is light. You know, we want that comforting arm around us. We want that gentleness and that from Jesus. But we really don't want to get in the yoke. Because getting in the yoke means that we're pulling in the direction that He is pulling in. That we're not going our own way. That we are ministering, because that's His heart, is to minister. Now, You know, I think it's a good sign when someone feels the weight of the impossible. If people have taken on a ministry, if people feel a burden for the body, for other people, and every now and then that becomes overwhelming, that's a good sign. Now, I know you shouldn't stay there because you should be depending and resting in Christ. Yet, when you are walking outside of that yoke and depending on yourself, and you realize you're carrying this load of concern for others and you're carrying it yourself, that means that you've been carrying that concern, but Jesus has been carrying it. So it's actually, sometimes it's a good sign if somebody tells me, I feel overwhelmed. I feel like I have too much, that I have this person and this ministry and that ministry. And yeah, there's times to cut back, but I also want to say, good, you're doing more than what you can do on your own. You better get back to trusting God because you've gone out on a limb and you're going to fall. So you better get back to trusting God. Now you should be somewhere along this path of being equipped. Each of us should either be moving towards God to enter into a relationship with Him, if we haven't yet, or we should be moving along this path to being equipped to serve Him. Now, granted, that in the beginning, that may just be your family. It may just be your children. It may just be your spouse that you are ministering to, because that needs to be taken care of to be able to minister to others. Yet, it certainly needs to move beyond that. It needs to move beyond that. So, you're being equipped. What are you being equipped for? For living? Well, yes, but more. You're being equipped for ministry. Ephesians 4:11 says that it's leadership's job to prepare you for works of service. You read that in context with all the verses around it, and you'll see it's talking about ministry. That the body is to equip you for ministry. So those in leadership should certainly model ministry in addition to training others to do it. But technically, you are a minister every bit as much as I am a minister. You're called to ministry. I'm called to ministry. Part of my ministry is training and equipping you to minister. But you are the real ministers. And this series that we're looking at, that's kind of gradually, I don't know where it's going, sort of gradually developing, is about Jesus calling His followers and preparing and equipping them for what He called them to do. Because He knew that His work had to be handed off to someone. He knew that His time on this earth, His time of ministering directly as a man, was going to be short. 3 years or less. And He knew that He had to prepare and equip someone to take over. And as the part B on your outline there, as the end of Jesus' earthly ministry drew near, at about 18 months before the cross, the crowds were growing larger and the opposition was intensifying. Yet, Jesus was extremely popular. But you're going to find out something about Jesus. Jesus didn't care about popularity. He didn't care about the, he cared about the masses. He was concerned about the masses, but his goal was not to attract the masses. He was going to speak the truth. His goal was to redeem. His goal was to save the world. And it was not through soft peddling His message. So, the crowds are growing. It seems like in a human sense, now any ministry journal would tell you, now's the time for the PR blitz. Now's the time to just tone down your message a little bit for these seekers. Let them in. Let them in. But Jesus did none of that. He continued. In fact, He did just the opposite. All along He was speaking the hard truth. But they now are beginning to hear what He was saying. Now Jesus was full of grace, compassion, and mercy. Yet, He was speaking the difficult truth. And the crowds were able to overlook that for a little while. But in these final months of Jesus' life, His ministry was going to narrow down to these 12 men because the crowds were going to leave Him. And you'll find that there's going to be a peak at about 18 months or so before the cross. And then you'll see it narrow down And when you study the last week of Jesus' life, he barely had any close, intimate contact with anyone except those 12 men, his closest followers. Now, granted, there was a bit of a growth in popularity just before the cross. It could be because there was a miracle of raising Lazarus not long before the cross. And there was a growth in popularity there. But then there was a complete falling away where no one was left. So let's look at one of these transition points of when the crowds left, when it narrowed down to these 12 men that were following Jesus. And I'll remind you, this is not a chronological study we're doing here. We're going to be skipping around a bit through the Gospels. But John 6:48. I am the bread of life. Jesus had just fed the 5,000. Now that was, it says in other places that was 5,000 men. So it's potentially 10 to 15,000 people. So he just, tremendous miracle he has just done. And the crowds are following him. They want him. In fact, they want him to be their king. So listen how he responds to this. This is a little bit after that. It's immediately following it. I am the bread of life. Your forefathers ate manna in the desert, yet they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Then the Jews began to argue sharply among themselves. How can this man give us his flesh to eat? Jesus said to them, I tell you the truth, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you will have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me, and I in him. Just as the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so the one who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven. Your forefathers ate manna and died, but he who feeds on this bread will live forever. He said this while teaching in the synagogues at Capernaum. On hearing it, many of his disciples said, this is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, does this offend you? What if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? The Spirit gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you are Spirit and they are life. Yet there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus had known from the beginning which of them did not believe and who would betray him. He went on to say, this is why I told you that no one can come to me unless the Father has enabled him. From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Do you want to leave too? You do not want to leave too, do you? Jesus asked the 12. Simon Peter answered him, as Simon Peter usually answered, out loud. Not always this well. He usually answered wrongly, but this was good. Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. The multitude's heart, the masses' heart, was in the wrong place. So they were not really in a place to believe. They were not in a place to hear what Jesus was saying and to understand. They had a self-focus and they had a temporal focus. What was going to benefit them in the here and now in this life. The 12, although they struggled with it, had been believing hard truths all the way along. They may not have understood fully the things that Jesus was saying, but they believed him. What they understood, they believed. Now, what this is referring to here is, I believe it is talking about on two levels. I think he's talking about one thing is an identification with the cross as indicated here. And this probably is one of the biggest hurdles, is to be identified with the cross, both the dying to self and the recognizing that you deserve death, that you're a sinner. And these things had already been taught by Jesus. Over and over, he had taught about, take up your cross and follow me. But I believe what is indicated here is he's getting harder and harder. He's getting tougher and tougher, really, with what he's saying. I believe what's indicated here is a full identification with Christ, including his very life. Again, what he's saying is that Jesus must be at the core, that taking on the life of Christ must happen if we are to be true followers and disciples of Christ. A Galatians 2:20 thing, where I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but the life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who gave himself for me. That type of, and we're going to return to that idea. This is critical to understanding what the disciples were doing right, is that they had taken on Jesus' purposes and calls as their very own. They were that identified with Christ. Just another indication of the completeness of his desires and even his demands of those who would follow him. He had some other hard sayings too. What about in Luke 14:26? We looked at this last week, where Jesus said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." That's a pretty hard saying, is it not? You tend to brush over those kind of hard sayings of Jesus. But that's a difficult thing. There is to be a level of love for God that dominates our life. A level of love for Christ that dominates our life. Is this a part of your Christian experience? Is this the way that you love Jesus? Do you walk with Him in this kind of love relationship? Remember, we talked about the love principle a few weeks ago. The R.C. Cola, remember? Remember, commit, and choose. That when these guys were committing their life to Christ, they were choosing to love Him and follow Him. As a result, they had this kind of love relationship with Him. So, who did Jesus choose to represent Him? All this is going on. Who did He choose? What were these guys like? Who did He choose to represent Him and carry on when He left? Because it's getting harder and harder to follow Jesus. It's narrowing down. The ones that followed Him were 12 very, very ordinary men. God chooses the common and ordinary. Don't worry if you happen to be exceptional. God can use you too. But many times, God uses the ordinary and the exceptional. And immediately your mind may go to Paul and you go, well, Paul was brilliant. And that he was. But you know, his first missionary journey was not until the church had been going for 15 years before Paul's first missionary journey. And God made his point with Paul by such a dramatic turnaround to turn around a persecutor of the church to one who was going to suffer in the name of Jesus. So there were some special things for Paul to keep him humble. He was a brilliant man, but there were some special things there to keep him humble. You see, as we said earlier, as we serve God, it must be Him that gets the credit. And this is one way that He does that. He takes the ordinary people and uses them for extraordinary things. Let's go to Acts 4:13. When they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished and took note that these men had been with Jesus. Matthew 11:25. At that time, Jesus said, "I will praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, this was your good pleasure." And we won't go to the 1 Corinthians verse, but it talks about God using the foolishness of preaching. And you know, it's a funny thing, this thing preaching or teaching. The people that God will call to do this, and I can't help but think of myself in this as I read through these things, that if you looked at this group, certainly you wouldn't pick me out to be the smartest or the most well spoken. A guy that makes up words. When I can't locate one that'll work, that's a real word. And if you talk to me one-on-one sometimes, you'll find that I cannot express myself to you that well to make myself clear unless I've studied and prepared and have notes. And so, you know, on those, usually I come up here by faith and I just throw it down, trusting God to do with it what He will. Every now and then, not often, every once in a while, I'll hear word back that somebody's life has been dramatically changed by something that I have said. And you know my response to that? I'm not saying there's never would be temptation for pride and something like that. But my honest response is, I just chuckle. I laugh and shake my head and go, how could that even be possible? How could that be possible? God uses ordinary people to do extraordinary things, and He then gets the glory. It's what He chooses to do. He uses foolish men in foolish preaching and changes the world. That's how God chooses to do His work. Even the story of the smallest seed in the garden, the mustard seed, that grows to be the most impacting plant in the garden. It reflects God's way of doing things. And these guys were not exceptional. You know, you see stained glass windows of them, and you see them with halos on their head. I just cannot picture Peter with a halo on his head. Maybe now. They were not exceptional. They were working class and worse. Working class would be the best. They were the rabble. The elite would consider them. Just because we don't hear much about some of them, there's some of them we don't know much about. Some of the 12. But they all have a special place, and their names are permanently etched in the foundation, or will be etched in the foundation of the New Jerusalem, Revelation tells us. They were apostles. They were special messengers of Christ, teachers and powerful preachers, fully committed and specially prepared. The inner circle of disciples. You know, when you see these 12 disciples listed, they tend to be listed in three groups of four, is how they're listed. And the first four are almost always listed in this order: Peter, James, John, and Andrew. Those were the inner circle. Now, there was an inner circle, if you would, of Peter, James, and John. Peter and Andrew, you know, were brothers, and James and John were brothers. Two sets of brothers in that first four. The first one listed in the different groups is usually the leader. Peter has more words recorded in the Gospels than any of, he was always speaking up. About 75% of the time, it was putting his foot in his mouth. But he was speaking up. And he said he got the harshest criticism and he got the most compliments from Jesus also. The next group, now all those guys were fishermen. That may sound glamorous to somebody, I don't know. But if you've ever known anybody that was a fisherman for a living, those guys aren't glamorous. You know, they wear those white, at least they wear, the ones I know wear these white rubber boots, and they never take those things off, and they wear them when they walk around town, and they smell like fish, and they're not glamorous guys, you know. They may be a little rugged, some of them, but they're not glamorous. These first four guys were all fishermen. That's what they did for a living. Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew make up the next four. Philip, that's not the Philip that was the evangelist in Acts. This is Philip the Apostle. Bartholomew, who's also known as Nathaniel. A lot of these guys have two and three names. And then Thomas, who was doubting Thomas. Funny that he would be partnered with Nathaniel, who had the most faith, it seems. And Matthew, the tax collector. Despised. Despicable. A Jewish guy that's going to eke out money from his own people, take advantage of them, and use the Roman government for his own benefit, kind of. He was just despicable, coming and going. these tax collectors were. He was the guy on the street in the booth. He was not back in some back room somewhere. Matthew. And then the next group is James, who we know almost nothing about, son of Alphaeus. He's a James the Lesser, he's sometimes called. This is not the same guy as James the Elder, the half brother of Jesus. But he seems to be the leader of this next group. And then there's Thaddeus, who's also known as Lebeus. I don't even know how to say his. He's also known as Judas. And anytime you read his name, it says Judas, not Iscariot. So you have, and then Simon, the zealot. Now, to call him a political activist would be really kind. What would be better would be calling him a terrorist. Because that's more like what these guys were. You see, the Roman government was in control, right? They had no army. So what do people do sometimes that don't have an army to fight the people that are controlling them? They turn into terrorists. One thing they do, they carry these daggers. They would stab people in public to give terror. That was how they worked. And this was the organization, this was the group that Simon belonged to. Not exactly an upstanding character. When he was, or at some point in his life, I don't know about at the time he was called. And then, of course, there is Judas Iscariot, always listed, it seems, last in the 12, and always listed as Judas the traitor. Almost every time he's mentioned, it adds that to his name. Very different personalities, these guys, from boisterous types, aggressive, to guys that just would never say a word. But these men changed the world. All these different personalities, all these different guys. Now, at times, I'll borrow a word from my friend Steve Wittenberg. At times, these guys were boneheads. They wouldn't listen. Jesus would say to them a number of times, "Where is your faith, guys? What, can't you trust me by now? Don't you know who I am? You've been with me this long and you're responding like that? You boneheads?" That seemed to be sometimes that was like, come on, guys. But they had something special. And we'll get to what it is. There was something about them. There was something special about every single one of them. So, if God's not looking for the smartest and the most talented and the most exceptional, why is it that the church tries to compete with the world with talent, with personality, with money? Why does the church try to appeal to the world with these things when those aren't the things that God uses? We don't have to compete with the world. What we have is, if what we have is real, and if Jesus is seen, the power of our message is not dependent on our abilities. Now you need to be, we'll get to it, there needs to be character there, we need to be walking with God. But the power of our message is not dependent on our abilities. We are so used to operating in this realm. Success in the world. We think our success, if you would, in following Jesus, in presenting the gospel, and being used by God, is somehow that our abilities, our personalities, our charisma, our talent, that is dependent upon those things. But that doesn't appear to be the way that God works. He works through the power of the gospel. The gospel heats things up. You want to heat things up in a conversation? Just throw out the gospel. Tell people that they're sinners and they're going to die and there's one way to get to heaven. That will heat things up in almost any room. That'll get things going. Now, you know, I'm not saying that so you can stir up trouble. But that's just, and I'm saying to be gentle. And your life better be in line if you're going to be sharing the gospel. But the gospel is like dropping Alka-Seltzer in the water. There's a response. Sometimes it's a response of running from the fire, and sometimes people are drawn to the heat. The gospel stirs things up. There's a power in the gospel. It's not you. Well, I'm afraid I can't share. It's not you. There's a power in the gospel that has nothing to do with you. These 12 men turned their city and then the world upside down. These unsophisticated preachers who were not up to snuff in their day. Fishermen, nobodies, none of them were of renown. None scholars, none great speakers, and none theologians. You got to picture this. That was the nature of these 12 guys. That's what they were like. I'm not saying they didn't have strong spiritual interest and desire. But this is who they were. It's no wonder then that Jesus often went alone into the wilderness to pray. Often to spend the night praying. And on one particular occasion, right before He picked the 12, you know, He went off to the mountain, went out to the wilderness to pray. And He was about to pick men to be apostles. Now, you'll see that word apostles used in different ways, but apostles basically, in this, the way it's used here, is a special representative of Jesus. Now, there are apostles that just mean messenger, but in this case, these guys are special representatives of Jesus. Let's go to Luke 6, 12 to 13. One of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. When morning came, He called His disciples to Him and chose 12 of them, whom He also designated apostles. And then that's one of the lists that goes down through. I think that may have been the list we just used. But. Now, there's another verse. We won't go to that. 22:39 about Jesus praying. But Jesus here goes to God as a man would go to God. To seek God's face in prayer. And to commune with the Father about the men whom He would choose for this vital office. Yet I don't think He's going and asking direction, which guys should I pick? We have all these disciples. There were. He had a lot of followers. I don't think He was going to the Father and saying, which one should I pick? I think He already knew. He knew which ones He would pick. But I think He's interceding for them. He's praying for their strength, that they would be able to do what they were called to do. So they were these official representatives of Jesus. But it seems here on some days that their shortcomings seem to overshadow any potential that they might have. But when the call was given and when the hard message was heard, they did not turn away. When Jesus said, "You must eat My body and drink My blood," they did not turn away. When Jesus is saying through these things, "You must take Me on completely. You must eat, breathe, work, play Jesus. Jesus must be the reason for everything that you do. The house you buy, the car you buy, your recreation." Does that sound hard? That sounds kind of like, sounds like Steve might be being difficult there. That's kind of a high standard to set. I believe I'm repeating the intent of Jesus' words here. I believe this is what He's calling these guys. They take on at their core a different purpose and a different cause besides their own. And I know I said this very same thing last week, but it is a hard thing to accept and receive because we want to add a whole lot of Jesus to our life. Some of us really want to add a lot of Jesus and church things even and spiritual things and good books and good music. We want to add those things to our life, but at our core purpose, our core call, our core calling in life, does everything spill out of that really in reality? Or have we just added and piled on a whole lot of Jesus to us? They left everything they knew to be trained for something they had no natural aptitude for. To change the world. To lead. To be the foundation of a church. A supernatural organization that would never end in this world. These guys were not suited to this. Yet, they did not turn away. They left everything they knew for this cause. And the way things were done, and the way Jesus interacted with them, this set the pattern for the early church. How did Jesus train them? I want to read you a quote here, just so you know that it's not just me interpreting some of these things like this, from John MacArthur. You have a portion of that quote in your outline, but I want to read the whole thing to you. This is a quote on how Jesus trained His men. His example was always before them. They could listen to His teaching, ask questions, watch how He dealt with people, and enjoy intimate fellowship with Him in every kind of setting. He gave them ministry opportunities, instructing them and sending them out on special assignments. He graciously encouraged them, lovingly corrected them, and patiently instructed them. This is how the best learning always occurs. It isn't just information that is passed along. It is one life invested in another. Part of the effectiveness, I believe, of these disciples as they went out was that they did not just speak truth out of knowledge. That can be done, you know, speak truth out of knowledge. I'm not saying it's without value. But you see, they spoke truth out of the yoke, out of being yoked together with Jesus, a life that is all about Jesus. And I don't mean these people that are saying all the time, praise Jesus, you know. That's not what I'm talking about. I think you know that. But they spoke out of a life that was all about the purpose and the cause of Jesus. And they spoke out of intimacy with Christ. Go back and you read those verses in Matthew 11, around 11:25, and you'll see that just before he talks about being in the yoke, he's talking about intimacy with God. And I believe these guys were speaking the truth, knowledge, but not out of knowledge. They were speaking it out of being in the yoke, and they were speaking it out of intimacy with Christ. So you ask me, what in the world are you talking about? Or more honestly, you may ask, what are you asking of me? What is this asking of me? Of you and me? You are to be a minister inside and outside the church. You are basically to be a minister, ministry center. So, a lot of times, to help with the understanding of this, I have said your home is to be a ministry center. Now, that's not just for your family. That's to be, and I've called it a ministry outpost, and maybe that's not the right term. But a ministry center. You yourself are to be a ministry center, where your life is about serving God. Not just some mental acceptance of this truth, so you can say, I must be a disciple. But is it happening in your life? As one of the Proverbs says, as a mirror reflects a man's face, so what you do reflects your heart. So, if you're living this out, that reflects your heart, not what you say you believe. And Jesus also said, it's what comes out of you, not that what comes in you, that shows who you are. That's a big paraphrase there. Another question. Now let me, you know, we are all at different places of being equipped and prepared. And my opinion is that as soon as you start being invested in, then you start giving out. That might not be a lot. But you know, there is a point, you know, if you have a tank, like a water tank, you know, up at the cabin we have, there's this, the spring, you know, it's pretty secure now. There's no, moose can't get to it anymore. There's the pipe that goes into the mountain now. It's in the spring, and the water comes out and it goes into this tank, stainless steel tank, pretty good size tank. And the water comes in, and then there's a valve. There's a line out at the top, and then there's a line down here too that you know, the water goes out to some of the cabins. But then this line at the top is like the line that really feeds more of the cabins. So it's like as much water as comes in goes out. And so as the water's building up, there is some going out, but it's going to get to this place where it's just all going out. And it's just tension of, it's just right there. It's kind of like it just stays right at that level. It's like the tension of just as much as being invested is going out. And if you look at it, you say, well, that's a little uncomfortable because it could drop down or, but that's kind of the state of where we should be looking to move to, is to where we're giving out every bit as much as we have, is coming in. So the body should be investing and equipping every individual, but every individual should be given out at some point. I'm not saying immediately, but at some point in the process, everybody should be giving out, becoming a minister and given out as much as is being given in. Does your ministry ever bring you conflict, resistance, and persecution? I'm not talking about your own orneriness or selfishness or being offended, but I'm talking about your ministry, your true ministry. That's what happened to Jesus, you know, and he said that's what would happen with us, so it's not to be worried about. Is ministry becoming the core of your life? That's what he's calling us to. 2 Corinthians 5:20 says that we are to be ambassadors, all of us, ambassadors, representatives of Christ. Ephesians 4 communicates that we are ministers. We are trained and equipped to be ministers. And Galatians 2:20, which I've already quoted, says that I no longer live, but it's Christ that lives in me. I live for Him and for His purposes and in His strength. And Matthew 28:19 sends us out to all the nations of the world to go and make disciples. And as I already mentioned, Matthew 11:28, we want the peace and rest and the arm around us of Jesus. But do we want His yoke? If we're feeling burdened and weary, then we want somebody to put their arm around us. We want somebody to comfort us. But if you read the whole verse, it's about being in the yoke. Do we want His yoke? They chose, these 12 men chose, to forsake all and take on the purposes of Christ. All through the Gospels. It's not that many times, but we have this picture. We get this a few times where we see this, where people hang their heads and walk away when they understand the call. You see this often. They're following Jesus. They see Him from a distance. He looks really good. He looks appealing. That's a man's solution to the problem. Shut the door. I got it fixed. Okay. Where were we? All through the Gospels. You see these people respond when they really understand. You see all these people being drawn to Jesus like people are drawn to the baby in the manger at Christmas time, always cute and cuddly. But the closer you get to Jesus, the more you hear a little more clearly what He's saying, then you see people go, oh, I wonder if anybody will notice if I just kind of slip into the crowd. Because I see what He's asking for. And it's a little bit much. I've as much as heard people say that. And I've seen it on a lot of faces. They hang their head and walk away when they understand the call. Now, of course, we know we cannot take up this cause of Christ in ambition. We see that happen sometimes too, where people appear to take up the call of Christ. But it's really ambition and self. So Jesus was constantly dealing with the character of these men. Not so they could have wonderful, stress-free lives. That's the way Christianity is presented today, you know. So you can have a stress-free life, this wonderful life, where you can have love, joy, peace. All those things are great. Those things are good. But the reason that Jesus was instilling character in them was so they could be His representatives. Not so they could sit back and have a stress-free life. You know, I just want to touch on a couple of things. I think I'm done here. Close to it. A couple of things, just to remind you of what he was talking about with character. Very brief. You know, later, fruit of the Spirit would be a test of character, but this wasn't described yet in detail. The love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control, and all those. Which one did I forget? Faithfulness. I always forget that one. And the Vivant Corps always remind me. Jesus dealt with them deeply about humility. That was one of the major character things He dealt with them on, was humility. He washed their feet. He humbled them. He even embarrassed them with this one. He stressed them about loving God and loving their brothers, even loving their enemies. He stressed to them things that would reveal the cross. If He's going to give them their cause and purpose, they also had to have His character. And He talked much about forgiveness. Forgiveness was not a really powerful part of their culture. He talked much about having a predisposition to forgive. Predisposed to forgive. That means, are you predisposed to get offended or are you predisposed to forgive? If someone says something to you and it strikes you a little bit wrong, do you get offended? Or do you forgive? I tell you, there's nothing that will help relations in the body or relations at home more than being predisposed to forgive. I wasn't going to tell you this, but sometimes I'll just say things that pop into my head, you know. This principle right here, for Lori and I believe this has helped us more. I think it helped us more than anything else. The choosing to love is big. But this predisposition, and I figure if it helps us in our marriage, marriage is a picture of the body, it'll help the body too. This is something He tried to instill in these guys, not to be defensive, not to get offended all the time. Forgive! And I'll tell you, if it is the hardest thing, when somebody slams the door or walks away, not the Lord would ever do that. But to forgive them. Instantly forgive. And when you're back in the same room, there's nothing there. There is nothing there because you're an instant forgiver. That's one of the character things that Jesus pounded home to these guys. Forgive. Predisposed to forgive. This is one of the character things. If they were going to be representatives. The other thing He told them was they had to learn to rebuke one another. Help one another along. So, these disciples may have been, if I can use Wittenberg's term again, they may have been boneheaded at times and very ordinary men. Very ordinary men. But they did the main thing. They ate and they drank Jesus. They took Him on fully. They took Him on fully. They forsake all and followed Christ. They took on the cause and the core of Christ. And you know it when you see it, don't you? Don't you know it when you see it? They took on His purpose as their own, at the core of their being. And intimacy with Jesus was their strength. Those two things. And these ordinary men did extraordinary things because of these two things.